We need many things to fortify us as people. And if we leave ourselves without adequate resources, we could be in trouble. For example, what happens if I have to stop running someday? And that is what I call my therapy. What if I get injured? What if I get hurt? What if I get sick? If I am left in a place where that feels like the floor is falling out from under me, I'm going to fall. My goal with this research and my goal to help this community is to say, let's fortify the person, let's strengthen the person, which will eventually strengthen the runner. I want people to be able to run healthfully forever.
Welcome to the Trailhood of Trail Runner Nation, where we go on virtual trail runs with really interesting guests that are experts that teach us how to be better runners and possibly better humans. So this is what we want you to do. Lace up your shoes, grab yourself a UCAN energy pack, and put on your toe socks from Exoskin, and let's get down the trail.
Hey, today's guest is runner scientist Jill Colangelo. And she's going to talk to us about the mental health and well-being of our community. And it is a great conversation, Scott. I learned a lot about myself and the people I run with. We wouldn't be here without our great sponsors, and one of them is Jonji. It's their third release of the Fall Winter Collection.
And it's based on the American Southwest by the artist and runner Christian Gehring. And these styles are really cool. It's still the same good quality product, but they're with the Southwest print, so you can have that vibe. You can be cool.
These things not only look cool, but they feel great. They stretch right. They fit right. They have pockets around them. I just love pulling on a set of Jonjis and going out on a run.
And you can get free shipping here in the United States for orders greater than $50. Or if you live outside the United States, it's a flat rate, $20 for shipping.
But here's the thing, there's free exchanges if you just maybe thought you were a little bit leaner than you are because of the holidays, and there's men's and women's available, so you can take a look at their online catalog.
Jonji makes durable, sustainable, and they're a responsible company. They give 2% of their gross sales to make good, clean water available throughout the world.
Get 15% off with the code TRN at Jonji, that's JANJI.com, Jonji.com. with the code TRN. Scott, this next sponsor we've been with for years. And you know why? Because they don't stink. That's why, Scott. Can you guess who it is? It's Native Deodorant.
Native Deodorant. My favorite part of the year is coming up. That's the holiday season. It brings to my memory the great smells of the holidays. And speaking of those smells, we have to tell you about Native's awesome new holiday-inspired scent collection.
If you want to smell like a candy cane, a sugar cookie, or fresh mistletoe, you can for a limited time. It's the season, you know.
And here's the Native difference. They care about what ingredients go onto your body and that you're stopping the stink right away.
Giving the gift of self-care is easy with Native. And if you're looking for gifts, now's the time, Scott. You know, when a friend gives you deodorant, what does that say?
It shows love. That's what I think about. And with the new holiday scents, not only will you stop the stink, but you'll bring in the cheer of the holiday season. And you can find all of these seasonal scents at nativedeodorant.com. If you use the code TRAIL, you can get 20% off your first order at checkout. That's nativedeodorant.com. Use the code TRAIL. Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott War.
And I'm Don Freeman. And today our guest is Jill Colangelo. And she is a fellow ultra endurance athlete. She's run the long runs and holds a degree in psychology. She went to school such as Boston College and a Harvard Extension, published a great journal article on endurance athletes and the things that make them tick. And we're going to talk to her today about that. Welcome, Jill Colangelo. Thank you for coming on the podcast. And we met some year or so back when you started your research. You reached out to TRN. You said, hey, guys, I have to do a research paper, and I think some of your listeners might be some of the people I need to speak with. Can I reach out to them? Can we post this in some way? Talk to us about why you contacted us and why you picked this topic for your research about ultra people.
Well, I will sort of answer that in reverse. So I picked this topic because I actually went back to school to study psychology in order to better describe what I myself had experienced. and what I was seeing around me in the community as an ultra runner. So I decided to go back to school, and in so doing, it was an opportunity for me to really delve into the mental health aspect of what I was seeing and sort of find a way to put science to that. I wanted to be able to quantify sort of behaviors that I was seeing. And so I reached out to you guys because isn't this where all the wacky runners are? This is where we go. Isn't this the place? Hope everyone knows that I'm sort of being facetious, but it is true. I have been a fan of the podcast for a very long time. I listened to you back in the early days, and I just knew that people who are very interested in ultra running and trail running in general would converge sort of in this community. So I really needed to find the largest amount of participants for this study. I really wanted it to be as robust as possible. And so, of course, you guys were at the top of the list of audience.
You mentioned you picked your research topic from experiences you had. What is that topic and what experiences did you have?
So the title of my research is Prevalence and Type of Psychopathology in Ultra Endurance Athletes. And to be very honest with you, because again, I wouldn't have been able to do this without being able to just really dig into my own stuff. So I don't mind talking about my own situation. At sort of the beginning part of all of this, I had experienced really bad overtraining syndrome. I trained myself into the ground. As we've heard, people have these like weird symptoms. That's exactly what happened to me. I had a lot of physical symptoms, a lot of weird stuff going on. I didn't understand what was happening to me, and I didn't understand how it was possible that someone could kind of end up at this place from training as much as in a way that would be detrimental to their overall health. And so I became curious about that. I also became curious about observing other people's behavior in the community at large, seeing how people sort of interacted, the things that they were willing to do, the things they were not willing to do, their relationship with the sport. I noticed the relationship with sort of other aspects of their life, food, drink, society, culture, family, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I started off talking to you guys and made a little joke about, oh, this is where the crazy people are. But you know what? That's kind of a joke in this community. It is a joke with, as every joke has truth behind it. And I just became curious about that and really wanted to know if it was just observational, if it was just what I saw, if it was just my own personal experience. I started to see that it was more than me. And so that was really what led me to kind of figure out where all this was coming from.
So let's talk just a bit about that, Jill. What are some of the things that you saw in our trail running community that said, well, there's some stuff going on out here? What kind of things jumped out at you? And we're allowed to speak to this group, frankly, because we're all members of this, and I think we can take it.
Okay.
So go ahead. Yeah.
You know, the purpose of me undertaking this research was to help the community,
right,
and to really just support the community as much as possible. And so if I do speak frankly, you know, I am speaking about myself as well as us as a family
altogether. Please. And so don't hold back and feel free to say what you observe, because I think that's really, really important. And sometimes we need a good sit down from an expert to help explain us and understand ourselves.
Yeah, I will tell you about what I observed before I became a researcher. And then after, we can talk about sort of what the data showed.
Fun.
But just observationally, you know, I would see weird behaviors with how much people were willing to sort of sacrifice of their own lives to dedicate to this sport. People were willing to make really huge investments of their time, their finances, their energy, their effort to this sport in a way that I was not seeing in other places. And I noticed that the demographic was different too. For example, we're not typically elite athletes. We're not young. It seemed like people had a lot more invested personally, financially. They were capable to do things like travel to big races or, you know, get a coach and direct most of their life if they wanted to toward this sport. I noticed people had weird behaviors with alcohol. They had strange behaviors with food. People would be, you know, posting lots of pictures of their food that they were planning on eating or the food that they ate after a long run. People were talking about running races because of aid station food. People were talking about doing weird things to lose weight. You know, the weight thing is kind of a no-brainer. And then I would see situations where people had other more let's say, insidious or you know, mental health concerns that, you know, I saw in where I started running, lots of people who had been in military service that had been diagnosed with PTSD that were using the sport as some, as a therapeutic intervention. And we can talk more about that later and whether or not that's a good idea and so on and so forth. But I just started to see that there were a lot of different types of people that were grouped together in this sport. And some of what I was seeing, like I said, was just different than maybe what you would see at your average marathon, your average like road marathon, you know, or your average 10K. There was just something different happening.
So you looked at these observations and you thought, there's something there. I'm studying psychology at Harvard. How did you come up with the thesis and this research project that we're going to talk about? How did that come to play?
Yeah, so it's interesting because I studied at Harvard Extension School, which huge, an amazing program for, especially now with COVID and not being able to be present on campus all the time, is an amazing opportunity. So I went in there with this huge concept in mind of like, oh my God, I need to study this community. But there was very little out there in the way of other literature on this topic. And so when you sort of, I'm not going to say, oh, I'm a pioneer in this field, because there are people that have been working in and around this area for a long time. And all science stands on the shoulders of other giants, right? So all I wanted to do was just open this conversation as broadly as possible so that more people will become interested and have good data to stand on should they decide to study more on this topic. So for me, it was, okay, what is the most broad question I can ask, most simple question I can ask? And the question was just, is there more mental illness in this population or not? It was really just that. That was just the most basic. Believe me, I wanted to study so many things, but I really needed to leave it as broad and open as possible to sort of plant the seeds that would hopefully, that will hopefully grow into a forest of information for our community. So it was really just broad. It was, is there or is there not more mental illness?
I think that is a beautiful teaser for coming up, but I want to just take a one step back, if we may. You know, there are a lot of people that take pictures of their scrambled eggs in the morning to send them out, but talk about this community, about there are a lot of people that go out for a 3-mile run, but not a 50-mile run. And so taking things on big and trying to blow them up. And can you speak to a little bit about the personality or the mindset or the person trapped in this body that likes to do these ultra hard things and push against adversity and then come out with a story to share and post and sometimes brag about and sometimes commiserate over? Can you talk a little bit about this person that does these things with either alcohol or long trips or whatever? Can we dig into that? Does that make any sense?
It does. I think what you're doing is asking a question about the personality profile of someone who is drawn to this sport.
Let me rewind that. Can we talk a little bit about the personality profile of people that get engaged in this long trail running stuff? Yeah. Ryan, can you clean that up on post?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I'm sure you won't. Go ahead, Jill. Rescue me.
No, I understand what you're saying, because you're kind of looping together all these different things that we see all around us and we sort of recognize in ourselves. And science is trying to do what you're suggesting, which is, can we sort of enumerate what are the characteristics, what are the fundamental characteristics of someone who's drawn to this sport? And I wish I could give you an answer on that. And that's really what I think the research is trying to do as well, is trying to say, what is it about this group of people that makes them either drawn to this sport, or what is it about this sport that brings about certain characteristics in people? And that great chicken and egg question comes out in my research as well. So I will say that it is likely that there are certain characteristics that people share in this community. I can tell you like what I think, but what I can tell you is that the data, my data in particular, cannot answer that question. But I think observationally, we can sort of start to draw together certain, let's say, characteristics that might make someone interested in this sport. And again, I feel sort of shy about saying what those things are, because it would be unfair and overly broad in general, and it would not be based on the science. But I think we all kind of in our mind maybe can come up with certain things that we see over and over again in this group. I'm sort of hedging.
I like that. And I think it's important to delineate some of our experiences and prejudices or ideas from the science. And so I'm really glad with that. Jill, I need some help because I don't have my dictionary with me. Your thesis was prevalence and type of psychopathology in ultra endurance athletes. What is psychopathology?
Well, let's start with prevalence. No, go ahead. I got that one.
So psychopathology, okay, real talk, you guys. When you write a thesis in APA format, which is the American Psychological Association, they like certain words and they don't like other words. So for example, you'll see words like disorder and illness and psychopathology, which sound like big, broad, scary words, but really what it means is who among us has, you know, issues that we're more familiar with, things like depression, anxiety, eating disorders, PTSD, mm-hmm. OCD, problems with substance abuse, et cetera. So those kinds of things that we see all around us all the time, grouped together in a broad sense would be like psychopathology. So something diagnosable that we can point to and say, this is a mental health concern in this person.
So then you take this idea or this thesis and you decide I need to interview and do some scientific research with a group. Tell us a little bit about the group that you ended up talking to. Who are they? How many? Tell us a little bit about that group.
Sure. Well, I will say that in the way I conducted my research, and by the way, this was pre-COVID, the research was to be conducted online through a questionnaire. And it is very serendipitous that I chose that. Otherwise, I don't think I would have finished this thesis in COVID time. So people came in and they were asked to answer questions on a questionnaire. There were several demographic questions. So, you know, what is your sex? What is your age? What sport do you participate in? How many hours per week do you participate in that sport? Have you ever been diagnosed with mental illness previously? If so, what was that? And some other questions just about just general stuff. Everything was anonymous. And you were only able to participate if you were 18 and over. And the average age was 42, by the way, which I love because it really does give you an accurate prediction of our population. I had over 700 responses, but I ended up, after cleaning up the data and getting rid of some sort of anomalies and things that you sort of have to clean out, I ended up with a little over 500 people, 523. And when you do research in psychology, it's really important that you use, if you're going to use questionnaires, that you use validated questionnaires. And the reason why we use validated questionnaires is because we want to make sure that they have been proven to be useful and that they are proven to give you a response that is going to be optimal. You're going to get good data and it's going to be something that person's answers will correspond to their experience in their life. So the first one I used was called a PHQ, patient health questionnaire. I'm sure almost everyone listening here has answered one of these at one time or another in a doctor's office. And the second one I added because the patient health questionnaire did not, in my opinion, offer enough robust inquiry into the eating stuff. And our population, our crew has some eating stuff going on. So I wanted to delve into that a little bit more. So I felt that there's a second questionnaire called the Eating Attitudes Test. That's 26 questions that are designed to explain a little bit more about people's eating habits or the anomalies in their eating habits, as it were, so that we can get a little more insight into what's happening on that end. So those two, again, validated questionnaires were built into the survey. And then I got all the data on a beautiful spreadsheet and sat for a lot of hours staring at it. And that's how that went.
And what did you find out? I've been sitting on the edge of my chair. I want to know if, as a group, I'm a part of this group that it has this psychopathology that I just learned the meaning of.
Oh, clearly, Scott, you're a member just like I am and just like Jill is and probably the person listening. Let's learn a bit more about our group and our brethren and sistren.
Well, I will tell you that it did turn out that there is quite a bit more mental illness in our population than in the general U.S. population. I should specify that the study population did come from the U.S. in general. And I use the United States because obviously we have data from our U.S. population in terms of the rates of mental illness and the rates of anxiety, depression, and all the other sort of disorders that we may encounter here. So I wanted to be able to compare what was found in this study with the general population of the United States. So, for example, in the study, I was able to find that those who had a prior mental illness diagnosis, so before taking the two questionnaires in my study, 37% of the study population had been diagnosed with mental illness previously, versus the population of the United States is only 20%. So right there, we can see that there's quite a big difference. Then when they took the two questionnaires, the PHQ and the E26, the results from that would suggest risk. That's obviously not a diagnostic. You know, I'm not able to diagnose people through these two questionnaires. They are just risk indicators. And so after those two risk indicators, it was found that 46.5% of the population was at risk for a mental illness as described by the PHQ or the E26. And again, that's versus 20% in the US population. So there's that. Additionally, I will say something that was unexpected in this research that really, my research took a hard left, let's say, and it ended up forming quite a bit of the bulk of the results here, was that I was not intending to stratify the results by number of hours of participation per week. So I wasn't thinking of breaking people down in groups. I was like, oh, well, we're just one big group. I just want to see, is there more or is there not more? But I really started to see a very big sort of like linear relationship between how much people were training and how much mental illness was present. And so I decided to separate the population into three groups. The first group was training under 10 hours per week. The second group would be training between 10 and 20 hours per week. And the third group is those who are training over 20 hours per week. And when I stratified that, which is to say I sort of broke out the groups and looked at the numbers there, you could see a really, really strong correlation, as I said. So in the group that was running over 20 hours per week, and I shouldn't say running, by the way, I want to be clear that I opened this research up to people who are ultra endurance athletes across the board. So I had triathletes, I had some people who were ultra like mountaineers, I had people who were just cyclists, I had people who were doing all kinds of stuff for just very long duration. So it was found that the people who were training over 20 hours per week were 30% of them had, you know, serious kind of mental illness concerns and more substance abuse, more eating disorder, more depression, more anxiety. And it's a really stark kind of finding. It kind of jumped out at me. So we can talk more about what that means, but that's what I found in the data.
I don't know if you have an answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you think that this disposition for mental illness happened, is chicken or the egg thing? Did people with this disposition for mental illness join these endurance activities, or did the endurance activities cause the disposition for mental issues?
I wish I could answer that question. I think that there's evidence to suggest that either or both of those can be true. We do know that, for example, in the sort of health and wellness community, and also in research on physical activity for sort of normal folks, and when I say normal folks, I mean not us, we do see that there is sort of a mental health benefit of doing a certain amount of physical activity.
Right.
But what we don't see is anything beyond about 150 minutes of physical activity per week. And so we don't really know what happens when you start to push the limits and what happens physically, what happens mentally to a person when they start really piling on the hours and the miles, et cetera, et cetera. So whatever ameliorative effect someone thinks they're getting from doing this sport and doing it more, it is unclear whether or not that's actually happening, but you can obviously see why someone would be drawn to trying it out, right? Like if you feel good when you run 10 miles a week, what happens if you run 20 or 30 or 40 and all it goes all the way up from there? So it could be that people with mental illness of all, you know, flavors are drawn to the sport because of a perceived ameliorative effect, that they perceive that it is going to make them feel better. It could be that it does provide a benefit to them mentally. You know, there's no arguing with that. Like, everybody listening to this right now knows that they feel good when they're running or participating in a sport, especially with your friends, your community. That's a no-brainer. So it is possible that people are getting a mental health effect. It's possible that they think they're getting more of one than they actually are. It is possible, on the other hand, that people who didn't have any mental health concerns, once they become engaged with this sport, that they have opioid-like neurotransmitters popping out all over the place, and that there is sort of an addictive endpoint of that. Like, there is data, there's evidence to suggest that both of these things are true. So it is hard to say, it is hard to answer the chicken or egg question. We just know that one way or another, there tends to be more people with mental illness in this sport.
I'm just going to bring up this question because it popped in my mind, and we're in an open discussion here, right? No attacks. but the term illness, it makes me think, just maybe I have this characteristic, this mental disposition to do these things or act this way. Does that mean I'm ill? Just because I don't fit the mold of the rest of society and how the defined quote unquote normal is, does that really make me ill, or does it just make me different?
I think that's a great question. And like, we started off with this saying that, you know, when I wrote this thesis, I had to kind of conform to sort of the language of this. And I think that the language does throw up sort of a barrier in that, think about it, we're having this conversation and it feels like a red flag to you that describing mental health concerns feels like there's something wrong with us. And I think that is part of the stigma that leads people away from having these deeper discussions, and in effect leads people away from getting help and community and collegiality in how they feel because of that word. And so I truly think that the more people are comfortable with talking about this stuff, the less it feels like there's something wrong with us, and it feels like we're actually just having a human experience. So I completely understand what you're saying about that word. It does feel a little weird. It feels like a little off-putting. But the way that word is described in sort of the scientific literature versus how that plays out in real life, I think there's a real difference there. And my goal with this, as I hope is the goal with all mental health research, is to normalize and remove that stigma so that it doesn't feel like there's something wrong with us. It feels like we're just expressing the human experience.
I think that if you want to get your paper published in a Harvard journal, you need to speak their language and you need to say illness. If we're at a bus stop, we might not be using illness as a way to describe it, but you're in the scientific community and you need to speak with their vernacular and have their terms so that it gets past their editor. So I totally get it. I'm not saying that you laid down and you said illness, but you're in an environment where these terms are accepted and we just move on. Like on the trail, we use bonk and we know what it means. And except for our friends in England, we know exactly what it means and we don't have to describe it. So when you're in your own community, you really, you can use that language.
Absolutely. Yes. Every community has its terminology, but I want you to know that when I was writing sort of my proposal for this thesis and ran it by a professor that I was working with, and he corrected my language, it felt icky to me too. It felt really strong. Mm-hmm. I don't feel that it's easy language to hear. It's not easy language to write. And it felt off-putting to me. It felt weird, especially as a person who, you know, I've had obviously my issues of depression and anxiety through all of my adult life. I've said this in other places, but like before I was an ultra runner, I was a triathlete, and I am telling you that the pedals of my bike were pushed by just straight up sadness and pain for years and years. And I know that. And I know that when I felt bad about myself, all I want to do was get my running shoes on and beat my feet down the trail because that's what felt the best for me. And so when I had to write those words, I was talking about myself, you know, like I am in this data. We all are in some ways. And so it doesn't feel awesome to talk about it as an illness, but it does feel awesome to talk about it.
Mm, agreed.
As you're talking about that, Jill, I'm wondering, you know, does the exercise or the pedaling, the pushing of the pedals or running down the trail, Does that act as a therapy for these issues? I mean, you said that it was anger that pushed those petals down, and anytime you felt, you know, however abnormal, you would go out and put on your running shoes or get on your bike and go out. And was that therapy for you?
I'm so glad you asked that question. I really am, because people say all the time, running is my therapy or whatever, mm-hmm. you know. And I have to say this, all of the time that I spent beating the crap out of myself out there, it didn't help. It just made me need it more, and it wasn't helping. It would help momentarily, but it did not do anything to fortify what I felt about myself or my mental health long term. And so I know it's controversial for me to say this, but I do not believe running is therapy. I think therapy is therapy, and that running is a beautiful adjunct to therapy, and that mental health care really does need to be something that we pay attention to and take seriously with professionals. And hopefully we have access to that, which I know is another issue. But I believe that we cannot skip over fortifying the soul of the person by putting running shoes on and beating it out of us. That's, again, it's could be a part of a complete mental health care program, but it is not the complete mental health care program. We need many things to fortify us as people. And if we leave ourselves without adequate resources, we could be in trouble. For example, what happens if I have to stop running someday? And that is what I call my therapy. What if I get injured? What if I get hurt? What if I get sick? If I am left in a place where that feels like the floor is falling out from under me, I'm going to fall. And so this is, again, back to what I said before. My goal with this research and my goal to help this community is to say, yes, and let's also make sure that if anything should happen to you otherwise, if you need more resources, if you need stronger resources, let's fortify the person. Let's strengthen the person, which will eventually strengthen the runner. I want people to be able to run healthfully forever and not be lost if they can't use this thing that doesn't really, again, it doesn't really strengthen their soul. It just gives them something to do while their soul is still hurting. So we need a better solution to that, which is what I'm hoping to advocate for.
So well stated.
Hey, Jill, we're glad you stopped by today to talk to us, and we've got a lot more to discuss after this break.
Stay tuned, where Jill's going to help us understand how actual therapy can help us become better individuals and then better runners. UCAN offers the complete nutritional package for trail running.
And whether you're using the on-the-go Edge gels and energy bars or the energy powders to fuel your body pre- and post-run.
Freeman, they have low-sugar, grain-free granola snacks, too.
What I love about it is it's sustainable. It means I can use all of that energy instead of it spiking all of my hormones and my levels. I just have a slow, constant stream of burn. It's worth it. That's kind of how I run, Scott. Slow and constant.
We call it super starch. And not only does it give you that slow, even burn, but it's easily to digest. That's the key with UCAN energy products.
UCAN gives you everything you need to keep going and going and going for hours, and it tastes fantastic. Once you go to UCAN, you don't want to go with anything else.
And we have a even better deal than our normal deal right now. They have a Black Friday and a Cyber Monday sale starting on the 22nd of November going through the 30th. They're going to offer an outstanding 30% off with the code TRN30 if you go to UCAN.co/TRN.
I like what they've done there, Scott. 30, 30, 30. It expires on 11/30, 30% off and code TRN30. I love it.
UCAN.co/TRN.
I wish I was smart enough to make a question out of this. So bear with me and just kind of try to figure out where a question would be. I understand running is not therapy, that therapy is something that finds the problem, creates a solution, and allows you to go on forward in life without the same problem. That's what I hear therapy is.
I'm not sure about that.
Okay, well, let's take that on, and then I'll get to my thing that isn't a question, because believe it or not, I felt good about that. So let's tear that apart, because I'm part of this community, and I'm vulnerable and ready.
I think that therapy is not it's not a one and done situation. It's not like I do therapy and then therapy is done and I am now healed. I think that it would be awesome if it worked that way, but I think that therapy is an ongoing communication, and that it is an ongoing communication, not only with hopefully a healthcare practitioner, but it's also an ongoing conversation with yourself, because life is always going to be throwing stuff at us in many different ways. And we are going to need different levels of support at different times. And when we lose touch with what we need, when we lose touch with what's happening in our mental health, that's when problems start to creep in. You know, that's when we find people sort of either going back to sort of destructive behaviors or getting into new ones, you know, or we maybe even just see it in our own lives. We're getting short with our partners. We're not spending time with our kids. We're isolating. We're doing all these things because maybe we just weren't staying on top of our mental health. And so just as none of us would skip a run, right? I feel like none of us should be skipping that extra step of checking in with ourselves, finding out how we're doing. And so therapy is, to me, something, if the, like the perfect idea of therapy would be something that you sort of drift in and out of in life as you need it, right? Just like kind of anything else. You go to your doctor once a year, right? Go in for your check-in. Same thing with therapy, that it should be something that it should come in and out of your life as you need it. And that therapeutic intervention can come in different ways. You know, it could be group therapy. It could be one-on-one therapy. It could be, you know, Better Health or one of those apps that people use these days. You know, it could be different things, but as long as we're checking in with ourselves, it should be an ongoing fluid conversation for as long as we need it with no judgment.
Well, I'm glad I left myself some wiggle room, because if I could describe where my wiggle is here, therapy can be long lasting. It doesn't have to be two visits to somebody down the road. It can be a decade long, two decades, or an entire lifetime, hoping to reach some success where you can stand independently or realize that you need to check in occasionally to sustain the change, the positive change that you've made. So I hope that maybe that's the therapy that I'm talking about. No matter what the length of time is, it has a destination at some point to be more independent, either through self-checking in or checking in with somebody. It's there to help regulate and maintain some level of, not happiness is the wrong word, but function.
That's perfectly said. I love what you said about the function. By the way, function is a great word, because happiness is overrated. Really, what we want is purpose and functionality, right? If with purpose, we can keep moving, and functionality, we want to be engaging with life and engaging with our communities and ourselves. So what you said was perfect. It's like exactly right.
Running is not therapy, but perhaps running is a better alternative than maybe some alcohol or than a medication. Or if I can substitute that 5-mile loop and I'm good for the day and I don't need to turn to something else, at least it's a healthy substitute. What do you think about that?
So I think we can get into slippery territory with stuff like that. And part of the reason why we can get into slippery territory is because the danger is in the dose, as they say. So we're not sure how much running we're turning to versus alcohol. And are we getting help for that alcohol problem? Are we addressing the pain underneath all of it that originally led us to need one or the other? See, that's where I think the concern should be. It's not necessarily what are we turning to, it's why. What is it that we're trying to fix by turning to something? So that alcohol, running, shopping, gambling, sex, all of these things are maladaptive compensations for a very deep pain, you know, an anxiety, a question mark in our soul that is trying to be answered. And so it doesn't really matter what you try to fill it up with. If we leave people vulnerable to not answering that question, to not addressing that deep pain, we're going to have problems with whatever comes in to try to fill it up, whether, like I said, whether it's any one of those different behaviors.
Jill, if someone is listening to this episode and they realize that maybe they do have this pain that they're trying to mask with, whether it's running or alcohol or pills or sex or whatever, what's the solution? Where do they go? I think that's the biggest hurdle, is now what? Okay, maybe I have a problem. now what?
Yeah.
Do you go to a friend? Do you, I mean, where do you go?
Well, you know what we are doing on this podcast right now, hopefully opening up this conversation so that it becomes more normalized. So people maybe can go and find other people that they can talk to that have a similar issue. So first of all, if you have a trusted friend or family member that you can talk to, definitely. If you can see your primary care physician and talk about needing therapy and wanting to be referred to someone, yes. There are apps, there are online counseling services, there's lots of places where you can reach out to other people. I think though, that what you're sort of asking or what we all want to hear though, is that ultra running, I'm just going to say this because I hope it to be true, is going to be a community that accepts and cares for its own. And then ultra running is going to be a community that is going to have its eyes open to the fact that this is a concern in our group. And therefore we must open our doors and our arms to each other and say, hey, me too. Like I'm suffering with this also. And let's talk about it. Let's find a way to work on it together. I would love if there was like, you know, a group therapy session that runners could get together and talk about this stuff. That would be amazing someday if that's like a possibility. But I think opening the community up to understanding what's going on out there and trying to come at it from a place of non-judgment and community, because that's what we do well here, right? That's what we do well. And being able to just help each other find our way if we need to. I would just say, listen, open your ears to your friends and listen to what they're saying and share if you need to. But also, as I said before, there are plenty of mental health practitioners out there that are willing and able to help. Even if you think it's not a problem, there's people willing to talk to you about what you can do.
Jill, one last, and maybe this is an unfair question also, but the percentages that you identified through this survey may suggest that there are more mental issues in our community. How many of those are to the extreme of self-harm and suicide? Do you have any data that you gathered in your research for that?
Yeah, I actually, I'm glad you asked that question too, because it is something that was surprising in the data. In the PHQ, so that's the patient health questionnaire, there is a question that asks if someone is feeling or has ever felt as though they would either harm themselves or worse. And when we're talking about suicide risk, the word is non-zero. So anybody who says, yes, maybe once in my life I thought about it, that's a non-zero. So, you know, because suicide is extremely unpredictable and it is very difficult to pin down and the rates just keep growing and growing, right? It is very concerning. So when we have a non-zero, it raises some flags. So in this group, in my research, in the whole group, I had 12% that had either suicidal or self-harm thoughts at some point in varying degrees. What's concerning about that the most is that I did ask people if they had been diagnosed with mental illness prior. So those who had not been diagnosed with a mental illness, we would sort of intuit that they were not seeing a therapist or not under any type of mental health care. And so of that 12% of the participants who did say that they had considered self-harm at some point, 36% of those people had never seen a therapist or been diagnosed or been sort of worked up, let's say, for any kind of mental health concerns. That makes me nervous. Additionally, I will say again, to reiterate, that over 20 hours per week group, 30% of them were positive for like sort of the non-zero suicide thought behavior. So it really makes me nervous to think that there are people out there who are, again, feeling pain, because the concept of suicide is the concept of wanting to end pain, right? And so there's people out there that are feeling this way. They're running their brains out and they have never even had a conversation about their mental health with someone, maybe, right? So that's, to me, unacceptable. There's got to be something we can do there.
I'm going to throw this out there, not to make the great guest here uncomfortable at all, but this thought goes through my head. So we're talking about a segment of the population surveyed that are willing to go the extra distance, that are willing to push it further than the rest. So their thought of ending a life might be just their extreme way of thinking and looking at situations, of saying this sucks. I'm just getting out. It's the same person that might say, yeah, I can run 40 miles. That's no big deal, because they're willing to take anything to the extreme. Just a thought. This is a conversation. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think there's definite overall, there's, again, as I said before, there's sort of characteristics that people exhibit. There's overlap in sort of personality that would make them more likely to engage in certain behaviors than others. I think that that is way above my pay grade in terms of what and how we could look into that and see sort of where those, let's call them, reckless behaviors come from and what they mean. And there's people who are super mega experts in that topic. I've studied under a few of them at school, who would be really better than me to talk about the ins and outs of that. But what you're talking about is a personality characteristic, and it is likely or possible that we can find some overlap, definitely, in the Venn diagram between our people who participate in our sport and people who are also likely to engage in other sort of risky or rash behaviors.
Well, like any trail run, Jill, I mean, we're all allowed to be experts on a trail run, and I'll take it to that trail run. Back to what Scott said, if there is a group that has some hope of bringing this to the surface and having open dialogue and not feel threatened, it's the group, and I'll speak to our own group, it's what happens on the trail stays on the trail. How many times have you ended a trail run or a conversation on the trail run and said, man, you'd never have that conversation anywhere and feel safe about it, but on this trail? And there's some type of camaraderie that happens there, and people take it very seriously. And what I believe, what is said on the trail does stay on the trail. That's very, very true to our tribe.
And we've seen each other at the very worst too, right?
Yeah.
We've seen each other at the side of a trail on our hands and knees, puking our guts out, or with our pants down around our ankles, trying to get rid of something you need to get rid of, or at an extreme bonk where somebody's laying down, just moaning. We've seen the very worst, and this is just a different version of that. And we're accepting of that. We empower that. Let's talk about it. That's where the best stories come from, right, Don?
Yeah, and it's humanity, and it's exposed, and we accept it, and we embrace it, and we treasure it, and I think we understand it. Out there, when you take off all the shields that you try to put up and the masks that you put on in life, you just become true to who you are out there, and maybe that's why this conversation will be successful. And while you have done this, Jill, and looked at your endurance community and brought in all the cousins, not just the runners, but also the triathletes and the kayakers and the mountain climbers and the people that take it to the next limit, that have exposed themselves in that way to be true to who they are and embrace one another, you know, good for you for taking on that group where it had the biggest chance to be fruitful.
Every awesome person I know in my life, and some of the most amazing and beautiful experiences I've ever had have been as a direct result of this community. There's no question in my mind. I've met like some of my lifelong, you know, ride or die best friends. I've, just like you guys said, had these just amazing conversations with people like in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night, you know, and just have experienced such incredible generosity of spirit from this community. And so how could I not want to support it in any way possible? And by the way, I just want to make clear, it is very obvious that I'm not the first person to talk about mental health in our community. There are way more important, famous, you know, people and runners than I will ever, ever, ever be, who have been talking about mental health in this community for a very long time, some very big names. And I think that the only thing I've done differently is just apply some numbers to it. You know, I've just made data come out from under it, but it's been there for a very long time. The one thing that I love what you guys are saying is that it is something that needs to be normalized and found to be within and among all of us, because those famous names are famous names, but we are all the common kind of group that are all around. And so I would hate it if people thought that it was just happening to those like very few people. and that it's not okay to happen to us because we're like the, you know, we're like the reg runners. We're like the mid packers and the back of the packers. So it can't possibly happen to us. Like, that could not be further from the truth. We're all in this together. And so I really do love what you guys are saying about being there for each other.
I think at some point, you know, we've done it on the podcast. We talk about electrolytes and hydration and nutrition, the physical. We've talked about the mental toughness and the grit, but maybe we need to talk about eating disorders, and we need to talk about self-harm. We need to talk about some of these things because it's part of who we are. It's not just the physical and the mental part of trail running. So hopefully that conversation becomes more free in our community and on our trail runs and with a partner as you're running down the trail.
I agree. I think it needs to be, all the different aspects of this need to be, again, normalized, talked about, and shared. Because listen, if you are a runner out there who's struggling with any of these things, you are totally not alone. You may not have identified the exact characteristics in anyone around you, but they're there. Everyone has something that they probably are afraid to share, but you are absolutely not alone. Your running partners may be more similar to you than you think. And I just say that, again, not to say that we need to point the finger and try to like diagnose each other. It's not that. It's just, you've been in good company all this time because, you know, you're still in good company. It just now applies hopefully to this question. Let's hope that we can extend it to that.
You know, you brought up some the fact that some big names have been involved and had the courage to make mention of it, not only for their own healing, but the other people around them to have the courage to do the same.
Corey Reese recently came on the podcast and wrote a book about his struggles with mental illness. And the sad part of his story is that he just kept it inside. Those that were the closest to him did not realize that he was struggling. We need to break down that wall and break down that barrier and that fear and the embarrassment of talking about it. And I think that Corey did a great job by telling his story. We need to do it for ourselves and for our friends out there. What is, I think was Benjamin Franklin, I'm probably murdering this quote, but it said, if you're interacting with someone, assume that they're going through just a massive tragedy in their life, because 50% of the time you'll be right.
Yeah, I think that's very important. I think it's important for people to definitely break down all those stigmas. I think it's important for people to speak out. The least expected people are the ones usually suffering. For example, even in my study, I will tell you that if we break it down by gender, the group that suffered the most with undiagnosed eating disorder is men. That is not something that most men are comfortable talking about. And the problem with that is that I think that men are socialized to think about, you know, skinny ballerina girls. You know, that's what they think of as an eating disorder. They don't realize that the fact that they sort of binge eat after a race or withhold calories or don't want to eat carbohydrates, or, you know, there's many other forms and flavors of disordered eating behavior that are more sort of male oriented, you know, that they're not willing to sort of talk about or think about. And that's not good, because there's plenty of people out there, particularly men who have entered into this sort of transactional relationship with food and running. I run this much, therefore I can eat this much. Oh my God, I overdid it last night, so I need to go out and run more tomorrow. Like, that's not how you do it. that's not healthy. And that will get you into trouble real fast. And I think that like the female population is comfortable having that conversation, but the male population is not. Therefore, you know, we need to open that conversation up, because it's happening.
Hey, Don, I need to have a conversation with you on our next run.
When we hear somebody step up and have the courage to announce that, hey, I'm dealing with this, what is the reaction that we all have? As a community, we embrace them. We help support them. We don't push them off in fear of coming out and saying this is, wow, people will think poorly of me. They won't see me as the strong endurance runner that I am. In fact, we reach out as a community and say, hey, I'm glad you told me. We're going to work on this together. I'm sensitive and empathetic to your situation. In fact, I have the same thing. So it is what we need to do. And no one decides to outcast someone because they announce it.
As you're saying that, Don, I'm thinking back to everybody's had this experience where either you're the one that's feeling bad on a long trail run or long trail race, and someone else comes up next to you and says, I know how you're feeling. Hitch on to me. Let's get to the next aid station together. That's the metaphor of trail running that I love. We need to do the same thing for this mental illness stuff.
Yes, exactly.
You guys totally have the right idea. I love it. It sounds really great. It's just, that's what, again, that's our strength in this community is exactly that. Pick each other up when we're in pieces and help each other move forward, right? And that's the same thing here. That's exactly perfect.
And Jill, if we knew bigger words like you do, we'd write a paper. But we don't know big words like you.
Hey, if you want to learn more about Jill and some of the great ideas, if you want to read her paper, it's available on her website, which is jillcolangelo.com. That's J-I-L-L. That's the easy one. Colangelo is C-O-L-A-N-G-E-L-O.com. Or you can follow her on Facebook at A Case of the Jills, right?
I'm actually not on Facebook. That account is sort of it's sort of gone. I haven't used it in years and years. But its Instagram is A Case of the Jills, and you can look it up by that or Jill Colangelo. But you can find all the links to everything just on the JillColangelo.com website. You can link to my thesis. There's also links to the different places where I've published articles and whatnot. So yeah, and also you can send me an email or whatever. If you want to, you know, yell at me or throw rocks through the internet, you can do that as well.
I would recommend going to the Instagram because I was there last night because we do a little bit of background homework, Scott, sometimes, even though people don't recognize that for good reason. And you have a lot of great posts on there that summarize things so well. I tried to explain one to Scott and it took me like 9 sentences. And I said, but you can find it on her Instagram. She uses 6 words to say what I said in these 9 sentences. So just go there. So much good stuff there. Well written.
Thank you so much. You know, I started off this journey kind of just as a regular person trying to figure out why I was in this crazy thing called overtraining syndrome. So the kind of older posts are me trying to figure that out. And then I decided to go back to school. So it starts to get a lot more directed toward the research over time, but I just was not wanting to hide any of my journey and just wanting everyone to know what I was going through because I really wish that I had someone to explain it to me. If anyone is experiencing any of these sort of feelings, guarantee you're going to see something on my Instagram that probably resonates because I went through it too.
Jill, thank you so much for coming on board. We hope that this starts some discussions with your fellow runners, with your family, with your friends. We hope that it spurs on additional research so that we can really understand more, even beyond the tip of the iceberg that you've done here, Jill. So thank you for coming on.
You guys, it's been such an honor. Thank you for having me.
It was a great discussion. I know I learned a lot, and I appreciate your boldness, your frankness, and allowing me, I'm not going to throw Scott under this one, to ask some questions that weren't actually questions and to kind of meander my way through a thought and to maybe challenge some definitions or vocabulary with no disrespect, but just curiosity. So thanks for letting me do that.
So go out and run.
Mas.
We're going to take a break from the way that we normally structure our episodes. Next week, you've probably seen it on social media, we invited you to come and join as an audience member for a live recording of Trail Runner Nation. Well, we did that. And next week, you can tune in and see how it went. We may have crashed and burned. Who knew? Maybe we DQ'd. Maybe we DNF'd. You'll need to stay tuned. It takes a team of people to finish a race. It takes a team of people to put together a podcast. And we want to thank some of those people.
Our Patreon supporters, we appreciate their participation.
We want to thank especially our business Patreon supporter, Doug Crumley at Crumley & Associates. You can find him at Doug Crumley Jr. wealthadvisor.com. He's your wealth advisor. He's the one that's going to coach you to be wealthy.
We'd like to thank our producer, Doug Mayer, and our associate producer, Ryan Warr.
And especially our social media expert, Yana Gibalova, who just joined us and is doing a wonderful job.